Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Now, unlike the kettle, cooker taps use very little electricity. This is why they're so good. They give an impressive energy saving results. Thanks to their advanced technology, it takes only, well, I'm going to give you some science now because that's the sort of guy I am, you know, I see myself as a scientist. It takes only 10 watts to keep water in the tank at 110 degrees, while the average kettle uses 2200 watts to boil 1.7 liters of water. This means not only will you save time with instant boiling water available within seconds, but you'll also be saving money on your energy bills. How about that? And that is what we need to do at the moment with energy bills going up. Totally learned that, didn't read it at all. But it's good facts though, isn't it? I mean, you know, I love my cooker. I really do love it actually. I think it's such a great product. If you're interested, go to cooker.co.uk, cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R, and you can see all the models there and prices and everything else. Today I'm curious about what it's like to be described as the most wounded survivor of the war. With the war going on in Ukraine, even though we probably have more access to the imagery of what's happening at any time in history, I think we still have no idea what it's like. We also have no idea what it's like to get injured in a war and no idea what it's like to live with those injuries when you come back. I think we're thinking a lot about war at the moment. And ex-USA President Franklin D. Roosevelt said, "War is young men dying and old men talking." And I think this is so true. The young men go out there, they die, they get injured, they get have PTSD, all those things, and they come back for, you know, old men to be sitting there trying to make these decisions. Anyway, Ken Bellringer was with a bomb disposal unit in Afghanistan, and he received some horrific injuries. I'd really like it. I think you're going to like this podcast, and I'd really like it if you do to respond if you could. Tim@lovejoy.co.uk. Be nice to send some messages to Ken, and be interested to hear what you think of it, because I think Ken's story is quite inspiring and also quite horrific to listen to as well. Anyway, I won't do any more introduction because I think it'd be better if you listen to him tell us his story. This is Ken. Hello, Ken. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Tim.
Thank you for joining me today. So I've just talked about you a bit in the introduction, but I said that it was best to leave basically the introduction to you for you to describe your experiences yourself. So I suppose we might as well start with what actually happened to you.
I was in Afghanistan in 2009, and my job over there was bomb disposal. And I've been over there a few months, dealt with quite a few devices. And on this particular day, we were tasked to assist a unit. We arrived and we were told there were six devices planted along a track. The unit had found the first one and then called us in. We dealt with that quite quickly, me and my team, and then we went to search for the others. As we searched along the track, one of the searchers found a device, and we needed to move back to a safe area. Then as we moved back, one of the lads, he stood on a device, but he didn't function at the time. And immediately we didn't realize that he'd stood on a device. We thought that he'd got his foot stuck in like a rabbit hole. And I was the closest, and I went to assist him. And as I went across there, I realized that he was stood on a device. I couldn't get to it. I couldn't take any action on it to make it safe. And the only thing was to try and get him out of there. And as I was trying to get him out of there, the device exploded. I just remember just things. It was almost like Hollywood. The things absolutely slowed down. I remember flying through the air. And I landed, and strangely, I felt no pain whatsoever. I didn't know what was going on. I had my eyes tightly shut. a ringing in my ears, and that was it. I remember being outside the helicopter. I could feel the downwash of the rotor blades and the heat of the engines and the sound. And then someone put their hands either side of my head and said, "We've got you." And I don't know whether that was my body saying, "Okay, you're safe now. You can switch off, go to sleep," or whether they went, "Here, have some drugs." And I went to sleep. And after that, next thing I remember is waking up in Selly Oak Hospital. And that was about 5 weeks later.
Okay, so before we get into that bit, if I can just go back to the actual incident. So was the colleague part of the bomb disposal unit?
Yes, he was the search team commander. So what he did, there are four searchers in a team, and he watches them search to make sure that they don't miss any areas. Where he'd actually stood on this device, it had actually been searched. The guys had gone over. There's a piece of equipment called a Valon, which is a metal detector.
Right.
And the searchers had gone over there, and it just wasn't found. Now, that's not the fault of anyone. At the end of the day, we were constantly having a battle with the Taliban, and they were trying different methods to try and catch us out. They were known for using low metal content or no metal content in their devices. And it's quite feasible that this device had no metal content in, so it just couldn't be detected. The searcher himself, the lead searcher, he was very, very good. He was one of the best searchers I'd ever worked with. And he'd already found a device. So, he hasn't missed this device. It's no one's fault, this. This is the enemy. This is what happens in war. It's just one of those things.
And I suppose there's no protocol for someone stepping on a device. Sorry if my language is clumsy, by the way.
No, technical terms.
But stepping on a device and then it not going off. I suppose there's not really. Is there any protocol? I mean, would you, in retrospect, dig round it and try and work out a way of getting out? I mean, I don't know.
It's a very good question. And, you know, in all these years, no one's actually asked me the question like that. And it was something that really, really bothered me because, you know, my whole training, everything I've done, the group that I was in, we're ammunition technicians, that's what we do. Our life centres around bomb disposal. And it's all about the disposal, not about the explosion. And I struggled with, could I have done something different? And it was only when I spoke to a very revered colleague who dealt with a lot of devices in Northern Ireland, especially, had been awarded gallantry medals. And when I explained it to him, he just said, "It's the impossible task. There is no resolution. There's nothing you can do. You couldn't dig in around it, because the ground's rock hard, and once he's stood on the device, he's altered the state of that device. So we don't know how long we've got before that might function. You need to get out of there as quickly as possible. To dig in and around it would have taken me hours because the ground's like concrete around there, and the whole there was no wires to attack." Normally, I'd try and attack a power source, prevent the device from working. But it appeared that it was all under his feet. What I did do was scrabble through the dirt around either side of his feet, and I couldn't find anything. So the whole of the device was under the whole of his feet, and I just couldn't get to it. And the only thing I could do at the end of the day was try and lift him. And it was... I don't even know whether I started to lift him or whether it was just as I was getting in position, the device functioned.
Was he stuck?
He was. He was absolutely stuck. He couldn't get himself on there. Both. It was very strange that it wasn't one foot stuck in there. It was both feet stuck together right on top. And it's, you know, if you'd had one foot stuck in there, maybe you could have got a hand down to try and pull yourself out. But the problem was he couldn't even get down onto the ground because just, you know, unless he was a contortionist. But then he also had a great big burden with a lot of weight on his back as well. So the situation was a pretty impossible and dire situation.
I can't imagine what you two would have gone through. I'm sure instinct kicked in to make the decision that you made, but I can't imagine what both of you went through just prior to the explosion. I can't imagine it. Do you remember?
In all honesty, I think that it was just so quick. The decision making was somewhat instinctive, based on experience and training. I knew we had to get out there quickly. I knew we had to get out there very, very quickly. But my thought process was, I'm going to get you off this device. We're going to get somewhere safe. I then know I've got a very angry bond to deal with, which is difficult to deal with. And I'm going to get you to a safe place, and I'm going to give you a right good telling off for putting us in that situation. You know, it was never a case of, well, this is going to explode and he's going to die and I'm going to get injured, because I would never have been able to defy any human being to do that. You know, because it just doesn't work.
How old were you?
I was 37 at the time.
37. Why did you join the army in the first place? And then why did you decide to join bomb disposal?
I think my dad was in the army, and, you know, my mum used to tell me stories of when they were in Germany, when they were in Hong Kong in the 60s and the 70s. And it just sounded great. You know, it's what I wanted to do. I always had that military interest. Initially I wanted to fly helicopters. And so I went to the careers office and said, I want to fly helicopters. And the careers office are a bit sneaky. They have quotas that need filling, you know, some trades need more people and so on and so forth. I went, you'll need to be a sergeant to fly helicopters, and the quickest way to sergeant is ammunition technician. So I went, put me down for that. And then I got in the trade, did a tour of Northern Ireland on a bomb disposal team, and then you just absolutely loved it, and all thoughts of flying helicopters went out the window. So it just went on from there, really.
Why did you absolutely love it? Because, I mean, obviously me and most of the listeners will be thinking, it sounds just such an extreme experience to be dealing with something which can kill you. Why did you enjoy it? What did you enjoy?
You grow into it. So there's numerous stages. The first stage really is being what they call a number two. So you prepare all the equipment. You load the weapons, and you drive what we call the wheelbarrow, the robot that you quite often see on telly. There's different ones these days, but for me it was the wheelbarrow. You know, you send that down the road and you shoot bombs with it, and then you get your operator in the big EOD suit and you send them down the road. So as you're doing that, you want to be the operator. You want to be the guy who runs the team, makes the decisions, because that is the aspirational step to go to. And although you may think it's dangerous, I suppose it is. It's about managing risk,
right?
And that's what it is. We manage the risk, and the situation I found myself in was an extremely rare situation, what we'd call a Category A. An immediate threat to life, it is very, very rare that it happens. I was very fortunate. I survived. You know, unfortunately, a very fine bloke was killed. You know, but through no fault of him, me, or any other member of the team, it was simply we were facing the Taliban, and that's what happened.
Why were you there at that stage? What was going on? Why were you trying to? I mean, I assume there's devices everywhere. Why was it you were actually in that bit of the country trying to?
The Taliban's method was the improvised explosive device. They had tried to take us on in conventional type battles, shooting at us, but the British Armed Forces. All three of them just overwhelmed them, so they had to change their tactics. And then the IED became precedent for them. And that particular area, we were just trying to dominate the ground. We were trying to make it safer for the local populace. At various times, there were elections over there, which has been in the media, in the news, and trying to support democracy and trying to support a different way of life.
So did you start as bomb disposal? Did you start when you, I don't know how long you were over there for, but did you start by having a sort of lesser role? And as the war went on, they sort of went, right, bomb disposal, you're the important people now, you're up front.
In terms of being over there, no, I set off over there as a high threat operator to deal with those kinds of scenarios. There are a number of teams across there, and we were just a cog in a very large machine. We needed other people to be able to do our job, and they needed us to be able to clear the way for them.
I read an article on you not so long ago, and it says that there's something that I get really frustrated about, actually, because I've spoken to quite a few people from the Special Forces on this podcast, and they always say, sometimes we're lacking the equipment. And I think if the public here knew how often we're sending people from in the forces into battle, into war zones without the right equipment, I think we'd all be horrified, because it's a hard enough job anyway without having the right equipment. I understand that was an issue for you guys out there.
It was a big issue from there. For me personally, it's something that we've really had to try and adapt to. And don't get me wrong, I absolutely love the army, but no system is perfect, is it? And there are frustrations all over. I just feel that we could have done things better. You know, there are certain pieces of equipment we might have been able to have, or we should have just done things a little bit better. But that's all in retrospect, really, you know. Were we doing the best we could at the time with what we had? Yeah, I would say we were. I would say we were.
But when you came back, did the eventually when you were fit enough to have discussions with people, what was there a post-mortem? Did people sit you down? Were lessons learned? Did they say, what did we do wrong, or has that not happened?
No, it was accepted that was part of battle. That was it, and things just went on. There was no discussion of that experience or how we could improve particular scenarios. Don't get me wrong, kit was coming through. Like I said, the Taliban were using, we had metal detectors and they were removing the metal. So just as we were hit, new equipment was coming through that was ground penetrating radar, right, which would deal with the threat of low and no metal content. But these things take time, you know, and scientists were working on it. And I believe at the time I got hit, there was one set that had come in, very, very new. Although ground penetrating radar isn't new technology, it's quite big. So to get it in a man portable situation where you can, one person can carry and use it, we just had one set, and that was with another team. So
yeah,
it was unfortunate in many ways. Maybe if the same scenario had happened a few months down the line, then the ground penetrating radar might have picked this up. But ish books, ands and maybes, I suppose.
Were you ever scared while you were doing your job? Or has it just become second nature to you?
A healthy fear, I would say. It's a healthy fear. It's quite strange because we had a time when there were four of us in Camp Bastion altogether. Now, this was very, very rare to get four good people, three other guys that I respect immensely. And we had this discussion, and we were talking about injuries. And I said, right, if I'm going to get injured, I'll take an amputation below the knee on one side. And another friend of mine said, no, I'd rather just die. And this conversation went on for probably about an hour. And in the end, one of us just said, well, we won't know anyway, because our head will be over a device, so we won't have a clue. And it was quite strange, because at that point, we all kind of like nodded, agreed, and went, yeah, that's it. And you then became in touch with your own mortality in some respects, and you just accepted. For me, it was just an acceptance of, right, that's it. And you just, you carry on. There's no thought that you're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. I've been over there 3 days, and a good friend was killed. And I remember saying to another colleague, I'm probably not going to make it back alive. Tell my wife and kids that I love them. And it was, when I look back, I think, I never once thought, right, I'm not doing it. I'm going home to my wife and kids. I never once thought that. It was just a case of, I'll crack on until I'm killed.
Wow.
Just, I don't know. I don't know whether other soldiers had that same thought, but it was just strange.
It's quite an amazing thought process, that. You must feel very isolated and different from the people back in Britain looking at you guys out there.
Being injured, although, yeah, there's obviously a lot of disadvantages, but I feel that the blinkers have come off a little bit, and I see different people doing different things, and in many people, first real thing was the doctors and the nurses, just absolute total amazement, and just a real appreciation of different things that different people do.
Yeah. You touched on it a bit before, but why were you there? Was there an understanding of why this war was happening? And were you having to, as soldiers, justify it to yourselves, why you were actually out there putting your lives at risk? Did you believe in it? I don't really know how to word this, Ken, without being I don't want to belittle it. That's what I'm saying, because it just seems so bizarre that we've just pulled out without, the other day that everyone's just pulled out after all those people who have died and got injured. It's just so strange.
I think I understand what it is, but the political reasons, I'd have to look into that before I gave you a solid answer on it. For me as a soldier, it's quite straightforward. Right, this is the task. Get on with it. I was there to primarily deal with explosive devices and save life. So in some respects, I didn't have those hard choices that maybe some other people had to do when they are in a different type of combat, when the enemy's firing at them and they're firing back. So that was quite straightforward for me. The political reasons, if soldiers were motivated politically, you just wouldn't have an army or an air force or a navy. It just wouldn't happen. Sometimes you just need to get on with the job and trust that those making the decisions are making the right decisions. Just within the structure of our society, I suppose. It's like anything.
Do you have any resent for them now?
No. No. Hmm. I am proud to have been a soldier. I'm proud to have done what I've done and the people that I work with. And I do miss it. I do miss it terribly. Not every decision that we make in life is necessarily the right one. And you can look at some things, and you know, political points are made about why we went into Iraq and why we went into Afghanistan and everything like that. But you could argue that if we weren't having to fight over there and people weren't dying, if we'd gone over there and nothing happened, no one attacked us, then maybe it would have then been the wrong decision to go over there. But when you're going over there and you're subject to what are essentially terrorist attacks, for my view, it was always a case of, well, we'll deal with it over here so we don't have to deal with it on our home soil.
Right, okay. And you must have so much empathy watching the Ukraine war, the war going on in Ukraine at the moment. And I imagine for both sides, because a lot of those Russian soldiers are sent there, they don't want to be there. And it looks like they're not a professional army either, doesn't it? It looks like they've just been sent over there for spurious reasons and they don't quite understand why they're there. And then you've got Ukraine soldiers trying to protect their country. You must have so much empathy for what's going on out there for those guys on the front line.
I do, and I look at the Ukrainians, and I'm like, yeah, you, amazing. I just the leadership, President Zelensky, thinking that's the kind of leader that you need. You know, he's almost Churchillian in his approach, and the fact that, you know, we're gonna fight because this is our country. We're not gonna capitulate. But yeah, people are dying, and it's very black and white. You know, for all your causes, someone dies, that causes a massive amount of hurt, and is it really, really worth it?
Well, what Putin's doing is absolutely insane. I just can't. I mean, I don't want to get too political on this because I don't know. I'm out of my depth when I'm talking about Russia, but he just seems like a madman, what he's done with. Anyway, I just can't get my head around it, what the purpose of it is. Let's go to the bit where you, we got to with your story. So you, 5 days, did you say? 5 days or 5 weeks?
5 weeks.
5 weeks.
I was in a coma for 5 weeks.
Oh, wow. And so what happens? Where do you wake up and what's the first thing that happens when you wake up? What do you think?
I just remember being wheeled down a ward. My first memory is being wheeled down a ward and everything smelled very, very fresh and there was bright light above me. So I instinctively knew, you know, I'd come off the battlefield all mucky, sweaty, messy, horrible, you know, and suddenly I feel quite clean on a bed, but I just can't move.
And then when do you find out you've been described as the most wounded survivor of the war? When did you find out what your injuries were? How did they break it to you?
When the explosion happened, I instinctively knew my legs had gone, because I'd seen it so many times, results of an explosion. But I didn't know anything else because, as I said, I had my eyes tightly shut. When I was in this bed, I had bandages right up to the top of my chest. You could just see my shoulders, but then I had bandages and my arms, both my arms were in casts, right up to the elbow. And then what I also had, I had a big cage on my hips, holding my hips together, because in the explosion, my pelvis had opened, what they call an open book fracture. So I had this cage that just pinned my hips together. And because I'm really, really lucky as well, what I had remaining of my right leg, I broke. So there was also a bit of external iron work on there. So I couldn't see the bottom of the bed because I had a big sheet going over this cage. And I'd been there, I don't know, a day or two, and there was an RAF nurse who is a very, very good friend now, and in many ways a saviour of my soul, a bloke called Aidy. And he was there looking after me. And he was, you know, he was straight to the point, an absolute great guy. Talked to me a lot, looked after me. And one day I asked him, I said, right, what are my injuries? And he sat down and he went through them all. And I went, yeah, okay. That was it. And it was like I was hearing it, accepting it, but not really understanding it. And when I spoke to him a few years after that, and he said, when you asked me that, that was one of the worst days of his life when I asked him that. So if he's listening, AD, I apologize for hurting you there.
Ken, I just can't imagine what it was like to hear that news. And so how long did it take it before it settled? Because you seem to have great, I don't know, control over your emotions towards it. I mean, how long did it take you to do that? Was there a moment of panic which set in, and or did you just, were you comfortable with it all from the beginning?
To begin with, I was just glad to be alive. So right. that's where you start. But you are also under a lot of drugs, you know, morphine makes you very hazy, so you're not thinking so clearly. But I say, to begin with, I'm just glad to be alive. And then slowly as time went on, I start to realise my limitations. And suddenly you start to realise, right, I'm no longer going to be a soldier. That's gone. What kind of person am I going to be? Am I going to be able to do anything worthwhile in life? What kind of dad am I going to be? What kind of husband am I going to be? And suddenly all these things start going into your head. And what I actually found was that a lot of people came to see me, and I was dealing with them, and I was being quite upbeat, and I felt like I had to entertain them, right. So I was talking to them and being jokey and tearful, you know, making jokes and so on and so forth, and being very upbeat about it. And then once everyone had left and you had the quiet times, I found that is then when it really, really started to hit me, and I really, really struggled, and I got to the point where I thought it would just be better if I was dead. And then you start thinking of, right, how can I make this happen? But I was in a bed with my hands, my arms in bandages, couldn't move because of this thing on me. So not only do I feel useless, I'm so useless that I can't even facilitate my own death. So I've got to the bottom, and I've dug through the bottom, and I'm still free falling. And I'm at that point. But then the next day, more people would come, and I'd just glaze over it, and I'd just hit it because I don't know. I don't know whether that was because I'm a man or a soldier, or if that's what people do. And for many, many years, I never admitted that that's the way I felt. And that was really hard.
Is it insensitive for me to ask exactly what the injuries are that you had?
Well, I lost both legs above the knee, and the left is really high. Amputation, as said, my hips were open book. I lost my testicles as well, Then I've damaged my hands. So I've lost both thumbs, and I've lost a finger on my left hand, and then parts of my other fingers. And then it's the fingers are bent over, and they're held in that position. So it's like a little hook. I've got a little pincer with two of my fingers, but that's about it. And then my right hand. Although I have my remaining fingers, four remaining fingers, there is damage in the palm of my hand, so I don't have a grip. So things are quite difficult. I can pick up a glass if it's the right shape and size. But some things are very, very difficult to do. And that's more frustrating than the loss of the legs. And I'm also deaf in my right ear. That's it as far as the physical injuries go, but what they mean is a totally different thing.
Yeah, does your mind end up going into the future a lot? Do you spend a lot of time thinking about the future with your injuries? Is that what happens?
I have enough time trying to live with today, to be quite honest with you. I do have to plan things, and I think that's the same for every disabled person, in that, you know, there are obstacles to being a disabled person that you never think of being an able-bodied person. You know, a little step here and there just absolutely totally stops you in your tracks, and they'll be the same for people who are blind. They'll have big obstacles for them, and people who are deaf. So, planning, yes. Looking to the future, not so much, really, because you can load too much hope on that, you know, because what you're looking for, are they going to suddenly be able to grow back limbs and things like that? It's not a good place to get your head into, to be quite honest with you.
I wonder what the effect has as well. Please, Ken, stop me if any of this is insensitive. And you know, I apologize if it is, but doing something like losing your testicles, which is, you know, it's just such a sort of maybe a horrible thing to happen to somebody. How does that affect you mentally?
Well, you have a lot of other injuries to deal with. So it's the least of your worries at that particular time. But then as you recover, it does have an effect. And what I've always tried to do is I've always tried to pick out positives. And what I said to myself was, okay, right. Firstly, I've got a absolutely fantastic wife and a loving relationship that's established. So there's one thing. And I've got two kids. So I'm very, very lucky in that respect. And it's not the most comfortable thing to talk about. Especially, I don't know, British attitudes, the way where we are.
Yeah, exactly.
And men don't like to talk about that kind of thing anyway, do they? But it is important because going back to not talking about that wanting to die, it does create issues. One of the problems we have is the majority of people injured in places like Afghanistan and Iraq are young lads in their 20s. And if they're losing their genitals at 20 years old, they don't have that loving relationship necessarily. They don't have those children necessarily. And they might have things to occupy them while they're going. You know, there's some absolutely fantastic things. Invictus Games, the charities, the military charities are absolutely wonderful. They do provide a lot of things. But then what happens in the prevailing years? What happens when that who was a young man lost his testicles at 20, goes out with his mates, and suddenly they meet a girl and they go off and get married and they have kids? And yeah, they're still mates and they're still part of that life, but that's all moved on. That is a natural progression there. Are there going to be mental issues there that are waiting to happen, and it becomes issues in itself? You know, there is no counselling specifically for this type of thing.
It's just having this conversation with you, I think, is really, really interesting. It's opening up a lot of ideas in my head and thought processes, and how just how horrible war is when you obviously there's death involved, but then there's also things like this which happen. You're right. If you're a young man and you lose your genitals, then you've got the whole of your life without doing. You've as you just quite rightly put it, you're back in society, but there's a bit missing, isn't there? And then how do you mentally
a massive bit
yeah,
bit missing. You're asking, especially with relationships, you're asking a lot of other people as well.
How did your family react to you when you came home? Because there's obviously your side of it and how you feel. How did they feel about it?
Out of everything that's happened, I have no regrets about being a soldier. I have no regrets about doing what I did. That is, that is part of life. But the only regret that I really do have is the absolute pain I put my wife and kids through, in terms of getting injured, being in the hospital and everything there. That's the biggest regret that I do have. And for my wife, she just puts it behind her. She's gone, no, that's done. I don't want to talk about it, because it was very hard for her and it hurt her a lot. So it's done, it's dealt with. We don't discuss it. Her therapy is we don't discuss it, and that's absolutely right. That's absolutely fine by me. The kids, they deal with it in their own way as well. I guess unless I sit down and try and have a group therapy session with every member of my family, I'm never really going to find out as to the way they felt. Or how they dealt with it.
And what about friends and colleagues from the army? Do they rally round?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like I said, people, lots and lots of visitors. When I was injured, what was nice was that it was quite funny. Because we have a rank structure in the army, and there are certain ways of addressing certain people. So I was a soldier. I was a warrant officer, another rank. So all officers I would call sir. As soon as I was injured, it wasn't Q Bellringer or Mr. Bellringer. It was Ken. And then all that's gone out the window now. I couldn't help myself. I still called them sir. But they all called me Ken. So it was quite strange in that way. I think people view it differently. I know in the past, when people have been injured, I've not wanted to visit them in hospital, because you just don't need to see it. And I don't want people to come to me and see that, right, this is what could happen to me. But one of the biggest things for me was, it was coming up to Christmas 2009, and when I'm in the UK, my job was as a troop warrant officer. So I was in charge of about 30 young soldiers, and on this Christmas, three of those young soldiers came to see me in hospital, and I remember sitting there thinking and chatting to them and thinking, I can't have been that terrible a person if you've actually come to visit me on your time off. And it was an affirmation to say, yeah, you're all right.
Yeah.
And for them to do that, and it's just something I just think about now, and I smile, and I absolutely think the world of them for coming to see me, and I think that's wonderful that they did. And same with a lot of other people. There were people travelling down from Catterick and Darlington down to Birmingham just to see me, and then go back. There were people travelling, finishing work, travelling 2 hours to see me, and then travelling 2 hours to go back. And it was just like, am I, I'm more popular than I ever thought. So, and they probably forgot about these things, but I remember it, and I think, yeah, thank you for that. That really meant a lot.
That's great. At the start of this conversation, you were very graphic in your explanation of what happened to you. So you obviously still remember it, the explosion. Do you get flashbacks? Do you get PTSD from it?
I don't know whether I've got PTSD. I think I've got depression. I think I suffer from depression. There are times when I just need to shut the world out. And, you know, when I talked about planning before?
Yeah.
I won't go anywhere because my head can't think. So I can't do the planning. So I won't take the risk in going out with a wheelchair. PTSD, everyone says, oh, you'll get it at some point. You'll mourn the loss of your legs. You'll do this and you'll do that. I don't know, to be quite honest with you. I haven't been diagnosed with it. I've read up what all the symptoms are and things like that. I won't be surprised if I have, and I won't be surprised if I haven't. Flashbacks-wise, yes, I do think about it, but I don't think about it in a traumatic manner. The only thing is I have is if there's a clash of two metallic objects, that'll trigger that sound of the explosion, and that will make me tense up. And then sometimes I could just be going along and the boom will come into my head. And it'll come into my head and it'll go within a split second. And it's like, oh, but carry on. It doesn't totally devastate me, but it jars me. It jars me.
So I suppose there's a part of your brain that has contained it and has it, and every now and then there's something triggers your brain to remind you of the incident and bring it back. I wonder also if you're, because I was just listening to something about this the other day, where your legs have been amputated. Can you still feel them at all? The bits?
Phantom limb pain. Yeah. I normally feel like I've got a tight pair of shoes on. And I've got tingling on the bottom of my feet. Sometimes I feel like I've had a knock on the ankle that hurts, or I've got cramp in my calf. And then I also get just nerve pain right in the end of my stumps, and it feels like someone's getting a sharp object and stabbing it in my stumps. And that's the worst one. I'm quite lucky on the pain. From I don't suffer the pain of a lot of people, but the downside is I've had so many opiates as pain relief, I've grown a sensitivity to them, so I can no longer have opiates. So, wow. So my pain relief now is paracetamol and ibuprofen. That's
right.
It.
Okay.
Normally when I have a bad episode of pain, it will normally last for about 3 days, and that can be quite severe, 3 or 4 days at the most.
How do you think as a country we've treated you since you've been back, as society and you know, the forces maybe, and how as a total, how do you feel you've been treated since you've come back?
Well, when I came back, brilliantly. Absolutely fantastic. You know, the army, and when I say the army, I mean the armed forces in general, but I was a soldier, so I'll always say the army.
Yeah.
They were brilliant. And I'll give it this way. Lots of people get injured every day, unfortunately. You know, people get knocked over, people have accidents that work on building sites and farmers and so on and so forth. They then have to spend a period in hospital, and they have a lot of worries. Who's going to do the work that's required to do? Who's going to bring in the money? What's their rehabilitation going to be? And actually, at the point of injury, who's going to help them? When I was injured, like you said before, when I was injured, I was the most severely injured person that survived. I had a 10% chance of survival, but I survived. Because I had a medic who had very advanced training and did some amazing stuff on me. I had other soldiers there who got in there and carried me up a hill. I had a helicopter with essentially an anaesthetist and a very advanced emergency care 10 minutes away. You just wouldn't get that in the United Kingdom. And then I'm put on a flight, which is made into a intensive care unit, land back in Selly Oak Hospital, or Birmingham rather, to get to Selly Oak Hospital. Absolutely amazing. And then when you've done there at the hospital, you go and you're rehabilitated. And it's the rehabilitation that's the big thing. And it's somewhat lacking, I think, for many civilians. We need to be better at that. That's something that the country could improve on. And I had some great therapists. I was very, very lucky there. I had some absolutely fantastic therapists who really helped me out. Unfortunately, prosthetics didn't work for me. I did try, but they just didn't work for me in the end. And but then since I left, we leave, and they say the point at which you leave the care of the services is the point at which the NHS takes over. The problem is, you're suddenly in this big melting pot. And what makes me more important than any other patient? Nothing. Everyone has their needs at the end of the day. So
yeah, I wonder,
it is a little bit frustrating.
I've got a friend who was out there as well, and he sadly got injured and had to come back. And one of the things that he always says is the bit that upset him most was the fact he had to leave the army, because he loved being in the army. He loved being a soldier and he adored it. And then I did a thing once, a curry day it was, sort of thing, with the Chelsea pensioners. And they loved still, you know, they were old, some of them were injured, some of them were paralyzed, some of them, amputees, et cetera, et cetera. But they loved still being part of something. And I wonder if that's something that we could encourage more, so you don't ever, you know, like you said, I had to leave, and then I wonder if we could keep people from the army in the army for the rest of their life if they have been injured, so they have a belonging and they're with.
See, I have a contrary attitude to that though, Tim. I can understand what he's saying, but defence is very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So do we accommodate people like me? Yes, I can do a lot. But what I can't be is a soldier. What I can do is as a civilian. You know, I could provide as a civilian within my injuries. What you need is, because the armed forces are shrinking down, the budget is limited, and we talked about the equipment before, we need to have the best people doing the best job they can with the best equipment they can, and that costs money. So let's not waste that money, on keeping me in a uniform, because it doesn't work. There are plenty of opportunities for people who leave the forces to maintain that link. I understand what you're saying about the camaraderie, and that is something that I really miss, and I think really impacts on the mental health. COVID hasn't helped. Some of the charities do. We have various coffee mornings, and there are things like Invictus, but not everyone can get on them. I think now, although I'll always class myself as a soldier, I am civilian, and what I want is for me to be able to be in there with people who maybe never served, so that they also help. They're also helped as well, so that they're not suffering. If everyone gets help, we all get on. It shouldn't just be, well, that specific part of society is supported at the detriment of others, maybe.
What a wonderful outlook. Did you know, by the way, that we've got the smallest army now since Napoleon times, and there was only 10 million people, the population of the country. We're now kicking up towards 70 million now. So we've really, as you said, shrunk the forces. We've really shrunk them down. Not sure, looking at what's going on in the world at the moment, it's the wisest thing. I mean, I've interviewed a few people on here who've said wars changed, things have changed. It's gone to sort of drones and you know, cyber war and everything else. But hold on, we're just watching a war where there's lots of boots on the ground and people fighting. And that's what we're witnessing right here, right now, only across the sea. So, you know, it's a bit, I don't know, it's a bit worrying, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't take ground with drones. You need them boots on the ground, and that's what it takes. And it's a massive combined effort. But I suppose again, it's these decisions that the people have to make. Defence is very, very, very expensive. And ideally, we don't want to have to spend money on it, do we? Do we really want to have to go to war? No, we don't. But we've sometimes maybe we're forced to.
The politician I was listening to the other day who was talking about this, and by the way, if you're listening to this, I'm so out of my depth on this because I don't know enough about it. But the politician I was listening to says, you don't spend money on armed forces. You end up with the situation which we're getting ourselves into now, which is where we're actually spending more trying to do things like, here you go, Ukraine, here's 100 million, and here's this and here's that, because we're creating these environments around the world. Whereas when we've got a big army, and again, I don't know all the arguments towards this, but when you do have an army, you pay your money so you don't have to pay out more money in other aspects is kind of the argument. It's you have a good defense mechanism so you don't have to spend fortunes on other things.
I do tend to agree with that, but there's got to be a point at which you say, when are we going to get involved? Does Putin stop in Ukraine? Where does it go? And is this not history repeating itself? How many things was Hitler allowed to? He was allowed to annex Austria, wasn't he? And he was allowed to move into other countries. And then we decided, oh, maybe we'll do something about it now.
Oh, it's such a complex one, isn't it?
Could be history repeating itself.
But there seems to be a reason that most of the you know, USA and Europe aren't doing anything at the moment. So, or apart from helping fund it, but look, we're not here to talk about that. Unless you want to. I mean,
It's a very deep subject, and it's opinions, isn't it? And everyone's got a different opinion. And,
I do spend a lot of time listening. Yeah, agreed. I spend a lot of time listening to all the opinions, and I'm like everything. I think I'm like most people. I keep swinging rapidly between views, and dependent on who I'm speaking to and how much how much knowledge they have on it. What are you doing to fill your time now, Ken?
You know what? I don't do much. One of the things I seem to miss in life is a purpose. I don't really have a purpose like I did in the army. And that, maybe I won't ever get that again. So I am involved with a few of the charities. Blesma, I'm involved with what they call Making Generation R. And we work with a great company called The Drive Project. And they teach us to tell our story within 10 or 20 minutes. And then we go around schools and we talk about resilience. And the theme is resilience. It started out going around schools, but now we go to first responders, talk to paramedics and doctors and physios. And also, we're doing military at some point. I'm very lucky. I'm quite near Cranwell. And I go down there occasionally and talk to one of the courses, which is great because I'm back in that military environment. And I can let loose a little bit when I'm talking with military people than I can with maybe talking to 11 to 18-year-olds. That's very good, but it's very few and far between that do that. I've mentioned the coffee mornings again with Blesma, and I'm an ambassador for Help for Heroes, which I find very interesting. Get to look at the decision making and get involved in there. And see the really good stuff that they do. For my sins, I'm the chairman of the Association of Ammunition Technicians. So our trade, we get together when we can and meet up. I'm sure that wasn't a popularity vote, though. I swear that was only because I was the only one that would do it. and it's just, I have these. Little things that I do that just keep me occupied and that. So mostly driving up and down the country for the kids at university.
I'm sure my listeners would agree, or the listeners would agree with this, that I find you totally inspiring. I think your purpose is your amazing stoic attitude that such a horrific thing has happened to you, and yet you're able to come out of it without, you don't seem to have anger in you. You don't seem to have a huge amount of regret in you. You seem to have an outlook on life. And you seem to, the biggest thing and the hardest thing for us all to do is accept things which have happened. And you seem to have been able to do that. I mean, I, as far as I can see, looking in, your purpose seems to be now is to spread your wisdom and your stoic attitude towards life. I think it's phenomenal.
Thank you, Tim. I do enjoy helping people because so many people have helped me, you know, and I really, really appreciate that. And sometimes just a little chat with someone can make a difference. Hopefully, when people listen to this podcast, you know, it might just, you know, help them in any small way it can.
Well, hopefully. I mean, I remember when my brother was diagnosed with cancer, and I've said this a lot, so excuse me if I'm boring some of my listeners, but the thing about my brother is he felt very, the thing I remember most, one of the things, is he felt very alone, like he was the only one in the world who had it. And we managed to get him to speak to some other people eventually who had cancer too, because he was a young man, you know, he was in his 30s and he had it too. And the relief he got from that was quite phenomenal, really. Like, I'm not alone in this. And I think that's what, you know, clearly that's what you can do to help people, because I think, I don't know if you felt this when you were lying in your bed, I wonder if you felt lonely for a while, like, you know, it happened to you and nobody else.
Only in the quiet times. And again, it does strike a chord with me that you said your brother was alone. I went down to Headley Court and I had loads of people there that had lost a limb, two limbs, three limbs, getting on with it, and you're just like, you lot are mad. But you can't quit, because they're not quitting. So it just drives you on. You know, you don't get in the jack wagon, what we call the jack wagon. You know, when you're out on a march, you'll always have a Land Rover following you. And if someone gets injured, they get in the wagon. It's called the jack wagon. So you don't get in the jack wagon. We don't give up, even though you do feel like giving up. That's just a natural thing. There's nothing wrong with feeling like that. And when you're on your own, I bet when your brother was on his own and you said he just felt so alone, I bet that's when he felt like giving up. But then when you've got them other people, they carry you. And that's what it is. This isn't my stoicism. This is other people giving me stoicism. This is other people that have got me in there and lifted me up. We're not meant to be alone. Human beings aren't meant to be alone. Even though we have to be alone sometimes, we're just not meant to be alone. And, you know, I've had family members with cancer, and even though we've talked, I've never truly understood how they felt. But I suppose they've said it was important for them speaking to other people who have felt the same, because you don't need to speak the words to understand sometimes. You just need to be in that group to get it. And that was the thing about Headley Court, absolutely, and now Stamford Hall, is you've got people in the same boat, so you don't need to have certain conversations. You just...
Ken, you're very wise and you're very inspiring. Thank you so much for doing this conversation today. If people want to follow you, are you on social media at all?
I'm not really on social media. As I said before, technology hates me. So if people listening to this could see the fun we had just getting it going, they would fully understand.
Mate, I'm in the same boat. I have no idea. I did like four or five podcasts, even that, without having the mic switched on, even though I was sitting there wearing headphones. So there you go.
But Aaron's got my contact details. So if anyone wants to follow that up, then
okay,
you know,
drop us an email. Aaron's the producer, by the way, if you're wondering. So yeah, if anyone wants to just drop me an email at tim@lovejoy.co.uk and we can pass it on. Thank you so much for joining me, Ken. It's been an insightful conversation.
Thank you. Right, my pleasure, and I have enjoyed it. Thank you, Tim.